we go. So I'm Rick Hansen. It's the 19th, correct, of December 2012. And I want to talk with you. I want to string together a series of topics related to the wisdom of the breath for the ultimate questions of futility and fullness. And I will explain as I go. So, I don't know about you. When I first came to Buddhism, it was largely through writing or reading. I read things. And so there I was reading, you know, Seven Pillars of Zen or the Diamond Sutra or these translations of translations of translations of what the Buddha seemed to have said. And it was all really kind of metaphysical and heady and pretty obscure. I don't know about you, but that was a fair amount of the Dharma, if you will, sort of seems to have that quality to it. So it's helpful, I think, to appreciate how much the Buddha focused on very, very intimate, elemental, sensual experience as the point of origin for practice. So I want to bring it down to the breath, something as intimate as the breath. And you might like to be aware of your own breathing and your own sensations of breathing as I start here. So what happens when we bring attention to something as simple, as modest, as humdrum, as the breath, right? All animals breathe in some fundamental sense. Even in a general, broad sense, even single-celled creatures, little protozoa, breathe in the sense that they exchange molecules with their environment continually. So when we bring awareness to the breath, inhaling, exhaling, we notice a few things very directly. One thing we notice is that it's continually changing. Right? One breath is followed by another, even when relaxed, maybe around 15 a minute, 4, 5, 6 seconds roughly between breaths, changes there. And then even in a single breath, a single cycle of exhalation and inhalation, so much is happening, isn't there, in the sensations. The sensations change, there's a fullness, there's a texture to them, a richness. There's a lot there, a lot of change happening. So we notice that. Another thing we notice is that the breath arises dependently. We breathe in connection. So breathing occurs in connection. For example, for the breath to occur, the lungs need to expand, the diaphragm needs to drop, the chest needs to lift. For exhalation to occur, kind of a reverse process. We also notice that our experience of breathing arises dependent upon the underlying physical material processes. In other words, we look at other people and we see that their bodies move when they breathe. So there seems to be something probably physical going on over there. And then we notice something similar happening in our own bodies when we inhale or we exhale. But we notice that our experience, the sensations, maybe the sounds of the breath, that our experience, the phenomenology, as it's called in philosophy, our experiencing of this physical hardware process is distinct from the hardware itself, right? We could be unconscious without any experiencing, and the hardware would keep moving. We could, without moving the chest, have a body memory that we could bring up of the experience of breathing that's in our experience. So there's a decoupling of the two, but they're intimately connected. And for us to have this phenomenology, this mind, this mental process of the experience of breathing, there must be some kind of underlying physical process too. And related to that, we start to realize that we cannot know the physical materiality of the world directly. We're only left with always our experience of it. Our sights, our sounds, the inferences we can draw. whether it's through a microscope or a telescope or through our direct experience, we can never know the world directly. We live entirely in a virtual world. You know, a book I read recently that I've learned a lot from called What the Buddha Thought, he makes the point that the Buddha had no interest in the world per se. And when he talks about the world, he's always talking about, he really means our experience of the world, what's actually happening in phenomenology, you know, in the bare sensations of the world, and then in our labeling or perceptions or memories of things, and then our sense of things being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then our various thoughts and emotions and desires and memories and hopes and dreams, and then awareness itself. So that's the second thing. A second thing we start to notice about breathing, that breathing arises dependently. And our experience of breath arises dependently on physical processes that arise dependently on food, on water, in a larger sense, dependent on the sun, producing sunlight that powers the plants, that power the animals, that power the food we eat, that power our body. Oxygen itself. Every atom of oxygen that we breathe was born inside the heart of an exploding star. That's how dependently our breath arises. In a single breath, we are dependent upon stardust. Wow. So we notice that. A third thing we notice when we look closely at the breath is that breathing can go on being just fine, both as a hardware process in which an animal is respirating, as well as the experience of it. All that can go on just fine with no sense of I involved. Think how much of the time breathing proceeds automatically, with no sense of me, myself, and I in charge. No one's conducting that orchestra of breathing, and all the sensations, the phenomenology, the experiencing of breathing, is proceeding entirely on its own. No one's in charge. No one is owning it. No agent is driving it. There really need not be any sense of self, in the sense of ego or I, present whatsoever for breathing to go on just fine. Right about now, you start wondering and realizing, wow, what I'm discovering directly, observing directly in something as down to earth and immediate and intimate as my own breath, as a single breath, could actually be applied to all kinds of other things. And then the third thing we notice, or a fourth, I'm on to number four now, about the breath, is that in addition to its impermanence, the way that it arises interdependently, and the way that there need not be an I involved, a self involved in it, and in fact, you can't really find a self in the experience of breathing. In addition to that, we start to notice that if we let the breathing flow, it feels pretty good. There's actually a basic kind of resting state of well-being involved in that. On the other hand, if we try to hold the breath, if we cling to it, if we crave for the breath to be any particular way, then you start to suffer. You know, take a big breath, hold it, start pushing past 20, 30, 40 seconds, gets a little uncomfortable. Flip the other way, exhale all the way out, hold the exhale, 10, 20, 30, 40 seconds, starts getting pretty uncomfortable. So we start realizing, interesting, huh? Flowing, letting go, seems to go pretty well. Living in harmony with the nature of breathing goes well. But craving, clinging, holding on, grasping, then comes suffering. We start noticing the basis of suffering in our own breath. So right there, in a single breath, we have the three characteristics of human existence identified by the Buddha: impermanence, interdependence, including to the point of no basis for an I, and dukkha, suffering, based on craving, directly in our own breath. We have the Dharma, the fundamental Buddha Dharma, in a single breath. And then getting a little more abstract, we start recognizing that in a breath is a fundamental rhythm in life of releasing and then receiving, exhaling and inhaling. We begin recognizing in that some very fundamental laws. You have to empty before you can fill. You have to exhale before there's room to inhale. You have to pour out before you can fill the cup with tea. All right? And we start recognizing, interesting, that there's this rhythm of life where I may give and then I receive, then I get, right? Or I need to let go of certain things. I need to empty the garbage. I need to clean out the closet, and then some new clothes can come in. Right? I need to deliver my undelivered communications appropriately, hopefully, in relationships, and then new love has room to grow. I need to weed before I can plant flowers. Powerful teaching right there in a breath. Releasing, receiving. Even to the point of, if you're so moved, to share a very profound practice, which can be done as prayer, from a teacher I had, Adi Da, thinking of something that's important to you or you're struggling with, spend a few breaths or a few minutes or longer focusing on letting go, releasing, just impediments to getting what you want, reactions, sorrows, upsets, emotions, what have you, cravings related to what you want, getting a sense of emptying out, clearing a space. And then when it feels right, take some time to invoke, to receive, to call in that which you would like, imagining ways it could happen, making room in yourself for it, often in the process noticing some kind of resistance or reluctance, and then shifting back into releasing for a bit till you clear that out as well. And then when there's a clearing, a greater clearing, or more stable clearing, then drawing in the good. I've done that myself, and if you like, as I said, you can do it in relationship with something divine, releasing out into the divine, receiving from, or simply releasing out into allness and then receiving back from allness without reference to anything transcendental. Either way. Still, a profound practice of releasing and receiving. In a very down-to-earth way, you need to empty the dishwasher before you can fill it. A lot of my great lessons in life, including related to gender styles of communicating, have to do with dishwashers. But moving along here. And then, going a step further, you know, less and less concrete, more and more kind of general or abstract. Releasing and receiving can become a broader experience of letting go and opening. And you may recall that I referred to this somewhat during my suggestions for the meditation. Letting go and then opening. There's two great movements. It's interesting that Ajahn Chah, the Thai teacher, great teacher, of people like Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, and others, had a saying that fundamentally meditation was knowing and letting go. Knowing as in awareness. There need not be a knower for knowing to occur. There is awareness, mindfulness, awareness, and also letting go. So letting go is very fundamental. So we have this rhythm where this moment arises in experience, and we recognize that we're going to start to suffer if we grasp onto it, just like holding the breath. You can't breathe if you're holding your breath. For breathing to proceed, there needs to be an ongoing letting go. So we focus on a letting go, a dropping. As Ajahn Chah also said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. It doesn't mean being stupid. You know, I've done a fair amount of rock climbing where it's stupid to let go in a certain sense. But I think if we can appreciate the notion of letting go in our own experience, even as we appropriately hold on to our savings account for retirement or hold on to our toddler's hand as we cross a busy street, then you can get the benefits of letting go without, you know, being foolish about it. The other side of it, though, is that as we let go, we're also increasingly filled by what we open to. That's the other side. You know, as we let go of righteousness and our positions in an argument with other people, we feel increasingly open to what is true in what they're saying, or a deeper wisdom that is common ground for both of us. Right? As we let go of banging away at certain goals that are just not working, as we let go of ever getting blood from that particular stone, right? Then suddenly there's an opening that happens. We start realizing there are other opportunities out there in the world. There are other things that could do it for us. America as a culture is a very acquisitive culture. It acquires. And generally most of us err on the side of holding on too much. That's definitely been my issue in terms of being ambitious or goal-directed or just doggedly determined, you know, holding on to a fault, determined to a fault. I mean, some people let go too quickly, but a lot of us, you know, really could work on letting go. And then to take it to the last step, then I kind of want to open it up to hear what you think about this and how this might apply in your own real life. This rhythm of letting go and openness relates to, I think, a very, very deep practice that I've been exploring and in my own experience and exploring with you out loud in here, related to what I've called futility and fullness. And what I mean by that is this. To enter this from a fairly well-known quotation from Dogen, a great Zen master in Japan, he said, to study the way, in other words, Buddha, Dharma, the path of awakening, to study the way is to study the self. And I think there he means self in two ways. One is that recurring presumption of an I, an ego, inside the mind that's continually kind of regenerated in our thought streams. And more broadly, self as in our localized business, our localized perspective, our own take on things more broadly, you know, the world as seen from the vantage point of this particular person. So he says, to study the way is to study the self and how self constructs experience. Second, he says, to study the self is to forget the self, is to let go of the self. So we increasingly let go of both this presumption of there being an I inside looking out through the eyes, and we increasingly move from an egocentric, self-referential, taking life personally perspective to a more impersonal, bird's eye view, big picture, allocentric perspective, where there's more of a sense of allness. And then in his third statement, Dogen says, to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things, or illuminated by all things. I think in both senses of the word enlightened or illuminated, we, the light of all things shines through us, and also we are awakened by all things. Wow. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. And I think that when we're relaxing more and more deeply into our breathing, when we're more and more grounded in the letting go, which is the letting go of self included, you're just relaxing, then what comes on the heels of that is an opening, a receiving, an opening wide out into all things. Often we just have a flash of that, an intimation, then it becomes a concept, of course, as we try to hold on to it. But then increasingly, we start having those flashes a little more often, then more and more often. They start having more intensity and potency and traction. They start landing more and more. There's a Tibetan saying from a very awakened master who said, in the beginning, nothing came. In the middle, describing his own history of practice, in the middle, nothing stayed. And in the end, nothing left. You know, these moments land more and more. You know, they say in Tibet as well, sudden awakening many times a day. You know. So, as we let go and open, increasingly we become enlightened by, illuminated by, lit up by, lived by all things, which goes to this exploration around futility and fullness I've been talking about. Much of the Dharma, I think there are two dharmas, two truths, if you will. One, which is the emphasized one that I've talked about here, is the pointlessness and the hopelessness and the suffering in trying to hold on to any moment of experience as a basis for lasting true happiness. Because every moment of experience is fleeting, and because it's insubstantial, that strategy, which is the conventional strategy, to crave and to cling to experiences of various kinds, that conventional strategy is hopeless, as well as full of pain. The flip side of that, though, which is the parallel, so that futility is the parallel to letting go. In the recognition of futility, we're motivated to let go. We realize holding on to experience is pointless and painful. In the corollary to, or the matching to, the opening, though, is a sense of fullness. What are we open to? We feel profoundly fulled by, filled by all the arisings. And as it lands more and more increasingly, we help the little soft animal of the body. I think that's Mary Oliver's phrase. We help the little soft animal of the body. You know, you've heard me say the inner iguana, squirrel, and monkey. I've elevated the rat to the squirrel because there are a lot of squirrels in my backyard these days. Anyway, we help the little inner menagerie let it land 10,000 times over through taking in the good, the truth of fullness, that we actually are fundamentally unthreatened almost all of the time, that we're actually fundamentally have enough and are really fed minimally by this proliferated moment of experience. And also, we are always profoundly connected and usually loved. And so on the basis of that landing again and again 10,000 times over to the monkey, squirrel, rat, and iguana, we can let it sink in increasingly that it's not just hopeless to chase after experiences, but it's also unnecessary because we're continually fed. Which then, to conclude, takes me to this time, this season, that on the basis of the recognition of the wisdom of letting go and the increasingly visceral, emotional sense of fullness, that moves us to all the way back to the simple basis of what the Buddha usually began teaching whenever he moved from place to place, which is the natural movement toward generosity. When you're grounded in letting go, when you're relaxed about exhaling, and when you're really soft and tender and open around inhaling, receiving, and fullness, the natural movement, isn't it, is to be giving and generous, which is completely appropriate at this holiday season. What do you think? Can you see that in a breath? Is this opportunity to follow that thread all the way through.
Okay. When you say letting go of experience, I'm not sure how it relates, but memories are an experience. You may have gone to the frog pond with your daughter, held her hand at a jar, and took a picture of it, and it's a fond memory, it's an experience. Yeah. You don't mean letting go of memories. What's the difference?
Oh, thank you. It's really appropriate to have the, as it were, fullness or the to open to that memory, right? And to even out of kindness for yourself, much as you would for another person, you would wish, like, I don't know you well, that said, I could tell immediately in your face, nice, good dad, you know, what a nice thing. I would wish that for you, okay? So in the same way, if I had a similar memory, let's say, I would wish for myself to have that pleasant abiding, to use that phrase of the Buddha, the pleasant abiding. Also, I might recognize that sort of memory is skillful means.
What?
Skillful means. It's a useful means to a good end. In other words, that perhaps calling up those various states of mind opens the heart or brings us closer to someone we love or helps give us resilience and strength at a tough time, you know, to get through a difficult situation with maybe other people or life in general. So it's okay. It's okay to invoke this. It's okay to call it up. It's okay to savor it, to take in the good, to help it land in the nervous system. And we can notice, just like a breath, it's totally okay to inhale, isn't it? To even realize maybe we're breathing a little shallowly, to take a deeper breath. We would want that for ourselves, you know? But we also notice that if we try to freeze that moment, it stops working, that we have to let it flow in the same way with whatever it is that we call up as a useful mental state. You know, it's that famous metaphor of the bird, right? If you hold it, if you don't hold it at all, it flutters away, but if you hold it too tightly, it doesn't live. So in the same way, we are to orient to our own experience. You know, I'm reminded of the Zen saying that one should be with one's mind like the rider of a skillful rider of a horse, neither too loose nor too tight a rein. You know, and the Buddha's metaphor actually, someone once asked him about meditating, and they were really stressing in their meditation, really concentrated on that breath, you know. And he said, do you ever play music? And I think they played music or something. He said, how do you tune your lute? You know, the strings of your lute. Do you tighten them so tightly that they can't play the proper note? No, noble sir. Or do you let them be so loose that they miss the proper note? No, noble sir. In the same way, you should be with your mind. You know, tuning it kind of just right. Yeah. Great.
So that, I'm just kind of saying that would probably like keep stuff, keep it in perspective. In other words, we're all one as a phrase where we all have memories. We're all, you know, we're all a soul in this body and we all come and go, you know.
Yeah.
We die, everybody dies, it's not a horrible thing. And we all have experiences. Meaning by letting go, it's almost like humility, where it doesn't matter, you know, you see your children come through you, not for you. You know, I'm also a mom, but I don't hold on. I let mine go because I know we're all one.
Yeah.
Come through you, not for you. But you hold on to these. It's nice to have the memories you're seeing, but remember that we're just spirit. That's,
yeah.
We're just, where we go back to spirit, apparently, I'm assuming.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what is keeping things in perspective on that way, right? We're all one and nobody's really different or better or worse.
Right. Yeah, well, thank you for that.
Well, I mean, I'm just assuming that that's right. But, you know, I've read and practice a lot. I'm on the perception part.
Well, one thing that's been true for me in my own engagement, you know, with spiritual life, is that the farther along people seem to get, the more beautiful their faces look, and the happier they seem to be. And I'm referring to people, you know, as the Buddha said about his Dharma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And even people that are way toward the end, you know, Ramana Maharshi, Pema Chodron, just. So many people alive today are not alive any longer. You just look at their faces like, wow. So that's hopeful for me. A second thing I'll say, kind of briefly here if I could, is around this growing recognition of interconnectedness, it's easy to be very conceptual about it. And at the end of the day, it really helps to bring it down to something real. And I myself get there in two ways. One way is to recognize that the experience in the moment, the sensation of breathing, the sound of coughing, a sight, this moment of experience is really being produced by hundreds of thousands of little causes. Neural processing, the sensations with other, interactions with other people, that the experience itself is really, really linked. And I think of it as a giant trampoline. You know, it's like a vast net with ripples moving through it, out into the universe. You know, for me, in a funny way, it's easier to get that experientially when I just look at my experience. Now, conceptually, I know increasingly that my body is intertwining with everything, like you were saying over there. And there's a, an arising dependently upon sunlight. If you just think about the energy systems in our body, it's slow sunlight. We are congealed sunlight. You know, we're basically stardust that are operating on congealed sunlight. Like, wow, you know what I mean? And so every so often you get a kind of jolt like that. But that's a little more conceptual. But again, in other words, that relates not to the level of experiencing, but to the level of materiality. But there, too, is an opportunity to have a sense of interconnectedness with everything. Anyway, so yeah, great. Tressa.
I experimented with the person who wears the name tag Tressa would like to talk with the person who wears the name tag Rice, and had a conversation like that. It takes a long time to have a conversation like that, but it really makes a difference in that sense of being connected. Yeah. It was pretty remarkable. And it can actually get kind of funny in the process, too. But it actually, like you said, many moments of having it happen, it started to do that. Yeah. And I've been playing with it this week because of last Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm doing more of that with the people, the person who wears the name tag. And it just seems like it's just maybe like these waves that happen versus these things that are solid. It's just
that's great. Yeah, that's very cool.
It's just with that one little trick.
Yeah.
The name tag.
Yeah. Whoa. That's great. You know. Yeah. And again, to bring it, I'll say this super briefly, then take more comments or questions. Fullness and generosity, receiving and releasing. You know, what an opportunity we have these days to, in very little ways, appreciate what we're being given moment by moment. You know, I was just reflecting, walking up here, several people were nice to me in little ways, little moments. And I bet several people were nice to you, too, you know, in the run-up to coming here tonight. You know, so many things are given to us, and then flip it around, how cool it is to just focus on generosity. Just the open hand, give it away. Okay, fullness and generosity in a cycle that feeds itself. Maybe another comment or so before we wrap up? Bill.
Where this remembering self comes in, I think, I'm beginning to think that this is, whether it has a name tag or not, it is so interconnected with our experiencing self. I don't know if you can have an experience without the remembering self evaluating, contemplating, reflecting on the experience in the moment, in the instant of being here now. You've got that all your history operating. Isn't that true? And the idea of letting go of your, let go of yourself, and well, I don't think you can have an experience then. So I wonder.
Yeah.
This is difficult.
Yeah. I think that's true, although I think you'd probably see that a very simple experience like a chocolate chip in the mouth or, you know, the itch of a mosquito bite or the sensation of breathing, you know, there doesn't need to be that much, and often there isn't any particular sense of personal history that's relevant.
I think that there is, the entity is still there, you just don't take it personally.
Okay, yeah, I'm good, I'm okay.
Maybe that's the wisdom.
Yeah.
Just don't take yourself personally, but I don't think you can eliminate, I think you can dispense with that person whether it's the being inside right. this bag of skin or has the name tag on it.
So
be with you.
So if I could, ask yourself as you're going to leave here momentarily, and hopefully we'll see you in a week, but you've got a week, you know, what's good learning for you around releasing? What's one good thing to kind of recognize about you and issues with letting go, releasing, or the recognition of the futility, the pointlessness and painfulness of holding on? What's a little thing to recognize? Like, for example, what's one thing that those who love you well would say, you know, you ought to let go of that one? Whatever that is, that little mental position or that drivenness toward a certain achievement or a rigidity around some kind of routine or a strange quirk you have or whatever it is, or a kind of grievance you're carrying, a resentment or a regret, a guilt. You know, suris, I love Yiddish, I'm not Jewish, but I love Yiddish because it's very expressive language. You know, these worries, whatever. Okay, right there, what's one thing? What's a good edge for you, a growing edge for you around the letting go, the exhaling aspect of practice? And flip the other way, what's one good thing for you in the week to come around the inhaling, opening, receiving, letting it land, enjoying fullness aspect of practices? Maybe it's a way to be a little nicer to yourself, or open to or encourage a little more pleasure in your life. Cuddle that pillow a little more. You know, take a little longer to eat lunch. Don't let people interrupt you while you're eating lunch. You know, whatever it is. Maybe actually staying there for a few extra seconds in the eyes of someone who cares about you, or is simply being friendly to actually receive it. Go to Grant's party, you know? Let that in, whatever. So what's your edge right there? Bring it down to earth. It's easy to kind of go off into metaphysics here. What's your practice? What's a good practice for you around exhaling, letting go, releasing, or inhaling, receiving, and fullness? Maybe in the interest of time, we'll end on that one, if that's okay. That's a good reflection, you know, where the rubber meets the road. Okay? So you want to sit quietly for about a minute, or Tom, did you have a last thing?
I just had a short announcement. Every night when we leave, we have to let go of the room by putting it back. Yeah. And so if everyone could just help by facing their chair forward in rows 4 on this side and rows 4 on that side, it's a great help to those of us who kind of put the...
So, Tom, I'm not quite clear. You mean just sort of turn it this way, and then you guys can move it from there? Because people have to get out of the room before you can reset it.
Especially in this area and in that area, they could just turn their chair around and face it back.
Oh, that's all. Just a little pivot, face the cross, which is not there right now. Okay, good. Okay, good. All right, so back to what?
Pardon me, pillows back in the corner.
Oh, good. Okay, and picking up pillows, back corner. Great, thanks a lot. Yeah, that's really good. So, Coach Rick here, channeling Coach Buddha. What's your practice around releasing? Bring it down to earth. One practice around releasing, and one practice around receiving. Okay, so let's just sit quietly for a minute, let it sink in. In every breath, you have an opportunity for a beautiful teaching. Take good care of yourself.
Merry Christmas.
Thanks. See you next week, maybe. Take care.